All right, so let's see if we can try to bring it all together. That essentially yesterday we considered the question of how crucial could Haseba be to any given mitzvah that it's a part of. The discussion is most prominently with both Dalet Kosos and Matzah, and we noted that we could split between them in different directions. That we would imagine that when it comes to the Dalet Kosos, it's easier for it to be a fundamental part of the mitzvah. For matzah, it's more of a stretch. And by the way, just to emphasize, I don't know if we made this point, but if you look at the Rush, the way the Rush discusses the whole question of whether Haseba is ma'akev by the Dalet Kosos, and he brings up that issue of mosif ha'kosos, how much do we have to worry that if you're going to be machmir and say, drink again, that could constitute a addition to the kosos, which is a problem for whatever reason, either for blurring the number or some type of rabbinic level baltosif. But one way or another, that might be a concern. So the Rush also puts into that conversation that maybe it's not a concern, because maybe if we say that missing Haseba requires us to do it again, so then Huvra Hadavar, it becomes clear that I never did it in the first place. That if I was lacking Haseba, so then the cup was disqualified, so it just doesn't count. So I don't have to worry that I am upping the number of cups because just doing it for the first time. So those two tzadim in the Rush, is it an issue of adding on or is it not an issue because the first one didn't even count? So it seems like that's what he's grappling with over there. Do we assume that the lack of Haseba is such a fatal flaw that not doing it means that the Dalet Kosos never even counted in the first place? Or should we say, no, it's a separate idea. It's just something that needs to happen. But once we are machmir to require you to do it again, so then that runs the risk of increasing our number of kosos in an unhelpful way. So that's as far as Dalet Kosos. Okay, we could believe, move more easily, that it's integrated into the mitzvah, because it's all a mitzvah d'rabbanan, and a mitzvah that shares the same theme of cheres, so 2 points in its favor of marrying the two. So we could hear that. When it comes to matzah, as we discussed yesterday, we saw some of the range of opinions, it was harder to believe that the mitzvah could really be tied into Haseba in such an absolute way, and that it was more likely that it's really about Haseba as its own requirement that is best expressed through matzah. But maybe it's still true. Maybe matzah really does have such a connection to Haseba that the rabbis took aggressive action here and said that if you're missing Haseba, the matzah is flawed, maybe even on a deraisa level. We saw some who thought that. There is an interesting technical question that some brought up. This question was raised by the Aderes. The Aderes was the first father-in-law of Rav Kook, and also others of Shlomo Cohen of Vilna raised the question. It said as follows, that if we assume that you do have to eat matzah again because you failed to do Haseba the first time, so they raised the question, why don't we just say that do Haseba for Korech and let that count? Because Korech involves eating matzah, right? Why don't we usually use that to fulfill our mitzvah of matzah? What's the issue? So the issue is that it's combined at that time with maror, and it's an uneven shidduch. Now you might think it's an uneven shidduch because maror and matzah have different themes, have opposite themes, right? Which is actually brought out in the Rashbam on our daf, right? That matzah needs haseba because of gula, and maror doesn't because of zechel avdus. That should be enough reason why there's a little bit of a clash there. But what's usually highlighted is the issue is that matzah is a mitzvah minat Torah. If we're going to use our initial fulfillment of the mitzvah of matzah, it's a mitzvah minat Torah. And maror b'zman hazeh is drabanan. So to try to accomplish those two together is an unequal shidduch. Jack?
Is it dafka because it's maror, or is it that the first kezias of matzah has to be eaten on its own? For example, like, could I put a spread on my first kezias of matzah or would I view it?
Okay, that's a great question. Gets into a few other issues. Let's leave that aside for a moment. It does involve problems, but we'll talk about that separately because this is a complicated point. So if the issue is that Doraisa and Rabbanan creates an uneasy shidduch here, so what if you have this scenario? You ate your matzah, but you didn't do haseba. So now you got to eat matzah again. What kind of obligation is that? So what we've established is it's most likely an obligation midrabbanan, right? That the mitzvah of matzah is probably fulfilled on a Torah level without haseba. So if you're telling me I gotta eat matzah again, presumably that's a rabbinic obligation to eat matzah again. So why can't I do that together with my mar? So then don't tell me to do another kezias of matzah b'haseba. Just tell me to do haseba together with Korach. That's a question a number of Achronim raise, the Aderas, Shlomo Mivilna, and others. And some say, Nachanami, maybe you're right, and maybe the whole situation is only because you remembered after Korach. But some raise the issue that maybe it's still an uneven shidduch. That the obligation to eat matzah again with haseba, are we ready to call it a daraisa? So we saw that's hard to say. It's hard to say that the rabbis so aggressively knocked out the fulfillment of matzah on a basic level. But maybe even if it's drabanan, it's still not equal to drabanan. That this is, the rabbi is really telling you that you have more to do to fulfill your mitzvah min haTorah, to satisfy the theme of the mitzvah min haTorah. Maybe that's still more than what maror is, b'zman hazeh. Which again, just kind of forces us to consider the impact and the relationship of matzah and haseba. And we mentioned on day one of this, way back when, that the fact that the Rambam goes in to haseba right after saying there's an obligation, laharos esatzmu ki'ilu hu yatzaata b'mitzrayim, and he quotes Psukim for that obligation. So could we say that Haseba is a Daraisa because of that? Right, in which case, you wouldn't even have to come on to saying that the rabbi has invalidated the mitzvah of matzah. You could say that the Torah required Haseba in matzah, which is a big jump. Like I said, no one's taking the position that Haseba is Daraisa, but is there really room to say maybe on some level it is? Or at least it's a Akiyam Daraisa, which might be enough for us. Maybe if we say that it's not an obligation in HaTorah, but it connects us to the Daraisa. The Torah never mentioned leaning as an obligation, but maybe once the rabbis told us that's what it means, it at least is a fulfillment of this Torah idea of Laharos Atzmo. And that still sets it aside from maror, perhaps. Which is something that's interesting to think about. One sefer drew the comparison, so this is also to give us a little bit of synergy here as we look towards Purim. So the Chasam Sofer has a idea in one of his tshuvas. It actually comes up in a number of places in his writings. It's in his tshuvas, but it's also in his Chidushim and Shas a few times. Chasam Sofer writes, and this is an idea which has many implications that are worth considering. Maybe hashkafically we'll also come back to it closer to Purim. But Chasam Sofer notes that here we're going to say, we're going to celebrate Purim. Purim, we don't say Hallel for technical reasons the Gemara raises. Chanukah, we do say Hallel. If you look at Chanukah and Purim together, right, so they're clearly Drabanan. Right? Chronologically, they have to be Drabanan. They postdate the Torah. And it's very hard to make the case that the Torah says, celebrate on Chafei Kislev and light the menorah. Or that the Torah says on the 14th of Adar, read the Megillah. Even though, as we've discussed a little bit in the morning, that the Purim, all the more so, because the Psukim and Megillas Esther have status also as Divrei Kabbalah, a little more than a Drabban. But the Chasam Sofer came at it from a different angle. And the Chasam Sofer considered that if one were, let's say, Chanukah for a moment, if one were to go over the entire period of Chanukah without ever saying Hallel and without ever acknowledging the Nes, that would have been a flaw on the level of Minat Torah. That, in other words, it's clear the Torah wasn't mitzvah to say Hallel on Chanukah. Chanukah didn't exist yet. Hallel itself is presumably a mitzvah to Rabbanan. That's how it sounds like from the Gemara, and that's a whole discussion too. We'll get to that in regard to the Seder night. But in general, let's assume Hallel is the Rabbanan and Chanukah is the Rabbanan. But nonetheless, despite all of that rabbinic stature, to leave out any acknowledgement of the Nes over the course of the whole Chanukah, the Chasam Sofer says that would be a lack of flaw on a level of Minhag Torah. That the notion of acknowledging the Nes and acknowledging God's Hashgacha is a principle Minhag Torah. How exactly do we know that? We'll say a little bit more about it in the future. But the fulfillment had to be defined by how the circumstances play out. Which is important, by the way, also for other technical reasons, because Rishonim struggle with how come Purim and Chanukah not Bal Tosif. Why is that not adding on to the Torah by adding extra Yom Tovim, and the need to see it as somewhat within the existing structure of the Torah is a part of that discussion. So it could be here also that yes, Hasebo was formalized as a Chiyuv Midrabanan, but it is a fulfillment of what the Torah is asking for with Laharos Atzmo in the context of Lel Pesach, and therefore it's at least a kium of a mitzvah min haTorah. And perhaps there again, that makes it an uneasy shidduch with Mar. Jack?
And the issue with not saying Hallel on Chanukah, could that be the mitzvah to listen to the
Divrei Chachamim? Well, so, but that we know already. So it's certainly that. But the question is even more than that. Is there something independent of that that addresses a lack of Lel Minhag Torah? Aaron?
What exactly is the issue with mixing the Reis and the Rabbanan mitzvah together?
So that's an interesting question to explore also when we talk about Korach. We'll get into it in a little bit more detail. But on the surface, it somehow suggests that one detracts from the other. And to say that I am fulfilling my mitzvah min haTorah, and I have this partner that's not coming from the same direction, not accomplishing the same kind of thing, and that's probably give you a mushel. So we say, this is, again, it's a conversation we'll get into a little bit more in the context of Korach, but we know that we have an obligation of smichas gula tefillah. And we daven shachar, so we have to go right from Shema into Shemona Esrei. We say Gal Yisrael, we don't interrupt at all. At nighttime, we have Ma'ariv, so we have the same structure of Shema before Shemona Esrei, but we do allow perhaps even require a little bit of an interruption. There's more in between Gal Yisrael and Shemona Esrei. There's a Kaddish there at a minimum. So some of the Rishonim explain that that's because Tfilas Arvis Rishus. Tfilas Arvis is on a different level than Shachar Simincha. We don't assume nowadays that it means it's literally optional, but it's on a different level of obligation than Shachar Simincha. So we have a little bit of a hefsek there. So you have to put a hafzek just because it's optional, sort of salivation explained in his shiurim. Other achronim explained like this also, that it's a problem. If you want to create one unit, if you want to create one entity of Shema and Shmona Esrei, so to have one that's obligatory and one that's not obligatory, it creates a problem. Now there you could say, oh, but there you're also dealing with the Raisas and the Rabbanans mixing. So again, that's something we'll have to come back to and explore a little bit more. But there is this notion that if you're trying to create a unit of two things, and they're not coming from the same place, they're not coming with the same level of obligation, then it creates a clash. And we'll, God willing, explore that a little bit more soon. So what this just emphasizes for us is, again, that maybe we could take the Haseba-Matzah relationship pretty far. Now, I mentioned yesterday, and just to expand a little bit more, so there is a discussion in the Sefer Chashukei Chemet, familiar with the Svarim of Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein. They're always quite fascinating, the questions he raises. And on our daf, so he talks about a situation that happened in the time of the Holocaust, where somebody had to work very hard to obtain matzah for the first night of Pesach. And circumstances being what they were, he was able to have the matzah, yes, but the Haseba, no. So what impact does the lack of Haseba have on the mitzvah of matzah in that case? And he raises the question, the same question that we discussed yesterday, that the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah considers the possibility that if somebody forces you to eat matzah Pesach night, you might be yotzei the mitzvah of matzah. And that the only question is, does mitzvahs require kavana or not? And the question we saw yesterday was, well, where's the haseba in that circumstance? How likely is it a guy breaks into your house and puts a gun to your head and says, eat matzah, where's the haseba? Now, we also discussed maybe even if there was haseba, would it even count, which is itself interesting. But let's assume, as he's assuming here, there isn't haseba. So, what does that say about the relationship between matzah and haseba? It sounds like you can have haseba missing and matzah still count. So, yesterday we saw a few approaches to that. What Zilberstein considers in this discussion is that maybe if the circumstances are such that haseba is functionally impossible, so then it's not crucial. And the question is this comparable, the question he discusses there, is this comparable to what our Gemara goes on to discuss, let's say, of Talmud Eitz L'Rabba? So if you have somebody who's in the presence of his Rebbe, and therefore there is a mora associated with that, so he doesn't do haseba, according to our Gemara. That clearly he's yotzei matzah without the haseba. So, is that comparable? What would you say? That the situation of somebody, a guy breaks into his house and forces him to eat matzah at gunpoint, so there's no place for haseba in that situation. And a Talmud Eitzel Rabbo who can't do haseba, are they comparable? What would you think? They fit, all right?
And it's like when you're locked up because of deep chaining you to the chair, well, there's really no way to get out. But Talmud Eitzel Rabbo, you can still look and say that. Well, you didn't have to be in your rabbi's house. You didn't have to be in that situation in the first place. So maybe that's not as severe of a case of bonus as the other one.
And so if you make a gradation, so then how does that help us then? So let's say, okay, one guy really had no choice in the situation, and one guy did. He put himself in a situation where it's impossible. So what does that do for us then, if that distinction is true?
And so the case where you're locked up, then it shouldn't be that your failure to lean is a great sarum in your tefillas matzah, but maybe you could say that it's more inclined to say that it is a tisarum in your tefillas matzah. If you had an option to lean by not eating your rabbi's house, you still chose a pathway where you wouldn't lean.
So let me ask you this question. So would you say, based on that line of thought, that we should discourage people from being in the Rebbe's presence on Pesach, setting aside COVID and we're discouraging it on Purim, that, let's say, God willing, a miracle happens a month from now, this is all over. So should we discourage people from being in their Rebbe's presence on Pesach because of that? They're missing out on Haseba?
I don't want to be on record as saying that.
Shepoz,
there's clear value in being at your eye's house and then talk to them before the restaurant.
But talk to them before Pesach.
Probably before Pesach.
Right.
Or when you're eating at his rabbi's house. But yeah, the Gemara seems to posit that you are able to eat at your rabbi's house, even though there seems to be still some problem there, at least in the Pesach.
Well, what I'm trying to elicit from there is that are we saying that this is very b'di'evid because he's missing out on Haseba, that we'll allow it because there's a side benefit from the educational experience, but it's flawed? Yossi, what would you say?
There's a mitzvah here.
Right.
The Rebbe was just something novel here, obviously.
So then that's an interesting question also. So how much does that play? It's also something folks can discuss. So, since the Rebbe has the ability to be mocha on the Yira, so should he? Must he? Is that better? So, how does that fit? Right, and how does that also fit in with the parent? Right, where the parent also has a din of Yira, and yet we don't assume that that creates a impediment. So, it doesn't seem like we're seeing that as a b'di'evid scenario. It doesn't seem like we're seeing this as any kind of a negative. Jack, you want to comment?
Yeah, a lot of these cases give me the impression that a seva is not a seva is really a problem if it shows that the meal is being treated as more casual than usual. So if it's talmud of neirabo, it's kind of expected that the talmud is going to sit normally, and therefore a seva is not a problem. It's not showing that the meal is more.
So the lack of haseba is not a problem?
Yeah.
I mean, so the lack of haseba, normally a lack of haseba shows that the meal is more casual or is less casual?
More casual. You're not doing haseba, that's showing that this is not like a real formal meal.
Because haseba is a show of formality.
Or something like that. Yeah,
it's an interesting take, because you would have said that haseba was at least rooted in a more relaxed position, even if we don't relate to it like that nowadays. But maybe that's the sticking point, though. The point is that Haseba represents something, and when there are other circumstances, it doesn't necessarily have the same connotation.
Right, but so. I think in this case of the Holocaust might be different, because, and in the case of the robber, because in those cases, I feel like it might be showing that it's really a compromised situation.
Okay, so that's a distinction that might be relevant here, and that's something that Zilberstein also considers. That maybe we shouldn't say that it's comparable to Talmud Eitz L'Rabo, because Talmud Eitz L'Rabo, okay, he has to adapt for the circumstances that don't allow him to be as relaxed as he otherwise would be. But within that context, okay, that's Derech Eiris. The Derech Eiris is for him to be there in this setting and to be doing everything else, but not to be leaning. While in Dagon point, that's fundamentally not Derech Eiris. And maybe we can't really compare the two. Maybe there is a major distinction between those two scenarios, which also further highlights our question of how much dissonance can we have? Right? How separate can we be from actually connecting to the chayrus emotions? If we're doing the outside appearances of Haseba, but it's completely at odds with how we're feeling, so how much can we tolerate? And that's essentially a very practical issue, because as we also started to say yesterday, that we have to figure out what to do about the Ravyo. Right, so just to recap that point, so the Ravyo is quoted in many sources, and some sources quote other Rishonim who say the same idea, because it's not such a surprising thought to come up with. That nowadays we don't relate to Haseba in a positive way. It's not easy for us to do. It's not something that is relaxing. And anyone who sees somebody lying down and eating, as the Rishonim who discussed this, hey, it looks like, again, it's already couple hundred years that we can't relate to this. He's already an issue of Rishonim we're talking about. But to see somebody lying down while eating, the image that you have is a hospital bed, is a chola. That does not convey any kind of luxury or any kind of cheres to you. So how exactly do we relate to that? So should we continue to do Haseba? Should we not continue to do Haseba? And the Rav Yah, as we saw, the Rav Yah says not to. And the impact that has on halacha is mixed. And the Beis Yosef says this is not the opinion that prevails. More recently, Aruch HaShulchan says poskim have not adopted this at all. But it does seem to have some impact, especially in the Ramah. The Ramah invoking it that at least with the Eved, we can rely on this idea that we don't need it, which has a major impact, practically speaking, on everything we're talking about matzah and it being ma'akev. Right? Because all of that discussion, and to whatever extent it's ma'akev, and the question we discussed yesterday about would you have to make a bracha again on matzah if you were doing it again for Haseba, all of that is all according to the Shulchan Aruch. But according to the Ramah, it's not practical anyway, because the Ramah says that, at least b'di'avad, we can incorporate the Rav Yah. So at least if we're looking at the question of, do you have to do the mitzvah again because of lack of Haseba, so you have the Rav Yah to relate to. And says that's also the issue when it comes to Nashim, that we went back and forth, that our Gemara says, Nashim don't unless they're Chashuvos. And we say that Bizman is that all the women are Cheshuvos, but still, they don't necessarily take on themselves a Seba, because once again, the Rav Yah got into the mix. And we also mentioned yesterday that there's some ambiguity about even if we want to accept the Rav Yah's position, what is the Rav Yah's position? No pun intended. Is it that you don't have to do a Seba, because it doesn't have the same meaning? Or is it that it's actively a bad thing, and we would want you not to do Haseba because it contradicts the notion of Cheres, Bizman Hazeh. It's not at all associated with anything positive or desirable. And we mentioned yesterday, Rav Sternbach quoted a chumra that was too much even for him, the idea that maybe you should be machmir to have an extra kazayas of matzah, one with Haseba and one without Haseba, which again really kind of goes to extremes to display Cheres in a kind of complicated way. But, again, even Rav Sternbach thought that was too much. But that's part of this question. The Rav Yah say, you can do without a Seba, or a Seba is bad. So the role this plays in contemporary attitudes towards the Seba is a big question. So here, the Aruch HaShulchan has a suggestion that it's an important piece of the puzzle. It says, the Aruch HaShulchan, that maybe it's actually better that way. It says, he comes off the premise that we don't factor in the Rav Yah as practical halacha, that all the poskim in his understanding have not followed the Rav Yah, and that the dominant view is that Haseba continues to apply. So with that perspective, he says, so why should it? What about the premise, the Rav Yah? Isn't the premise correct? That Haseba isn't something that's meaningful to us in our contemporary culture? So why should we still do it? If the Rav Yah's question is probably correct, why is it still something that we do? And he suggests that maybe actually that's better. Maybe there's a side benefit that comes with that. What do you think the side benefit might be? You see where he's going with this? All right.
I mean, if you say that it has no relevance on your internal emotional attachment to the overcoming, then that accentuates and highlights the notion that it's purely for either highlighting the Smenisa aspect of it or for the formalized testimony to the miracle of freedom of the
leaving. Okay, so that is basically the direction that he's going in. right, that if you believe, as some of the sources indicate, that there's specifically a persume nisa component to Heseba, so then the fact that it's unusual actually makes it better. Right? And we see also, to kind of support that idea, is that it is one of the four questions. Right? So the fact that it's a part of the Manishtana, so Kulanu Mitsubim, so it does highlight that it's there to seem a little strange. So the fact that it's a little bit countercultural for us is maybe a mila. Right?
It reminds me also of Arbus in general, how the whole culture in prior years was to dip everything in, I don't know, in dips, and then nowadays we only do it one night a year, and it's in the Nanishtana, and we do it for the questions, for the Dursimanisa.
So the fact that, and that's also interesting, and we'll talk about Karpas a little bit more also, we'll see how that also has some additional components to it. So the idea that this is something unusual isn't necessarily a problem in an absolute sense, but maybe it's even something that works to its benefit. Rabbi Shlomo Warman Shlita, I believe it was a Kernel Bracha, that's the way, a number of years ago, Rabbi Shlomo Warman in the Sefer Oros HaPesach, so he has a longish piece about the idea of Heseba B'zman Hazeh, like all of his writings worth reading. And he essentially comes at this from his own perspective, but says also that maybe that's a part of why Heseba continues to endure, because the notion of Pirsume Nisa, which we saw was more explicit in some of the earlier sources, especially if we say that we're corresponding to the Vayosev mentioned in the beginning of Peshalach, that the Jews were taken out in a reclining position. So all of that perhaps supports the idea that there is specifically a Pirsume Nisa component, and maybe that is actually strengthened by the fact that this is so unusual. Now that's all very interesting and could be. The problem is, even if that is all true, it's clearly not plan A. Right? That you can't say that Heseba was always set up with that in mind. Right? So if anything, that's got to be a after-the-fact svar. Right? You can't say that was the intent of Heseba, that it was never something that fit in. So what these Rishonim are asking is that it doesn't work with our culture nowadays, but it's not necessarily part of the core definition of Heseba, because at one point it made sense. So what we would have to say to work with this idea, to the extent that it's true, is that the Persume Nisa aspect of Heseba means that it continues to be meaningful, at least to a certain extent, even when it's not the cultural standard. Even when, in our contemporary attitude, Heseba does not equal Cheres, but the Persume Nisa component of it means that it continues to be meaningful in that situation, and meaningful even for the Ani who doesn't have a cushion, like Tosfos said in the beginning of the parak, to do it on, and that's the thrust, maybe, of the Mishnah, right? That even an Ani, that even in circumstances where it doesn't necessarily fit, it's still going to make sense because of Persume Nisa. But at its core, ideally it would have at least an internal connection. And that's where we have seen that if there is a complete disconnect between the internal feeling and the display, then there's a point beyond which we no longer feel any kind of meaning. So we saw various cases where there's a spectrum, and that we can handle a certain amount of disconnect between the feeling of Cheres and the display, but if it's a complete contradiction, like Heseba by Maror, for example, or maybe Heseba under Gunpoint, it's a complete contradiction, it gets too much. So if the question we had asked was, is Heseba about the external or about the internal. So the answer would probably have to be, from what we've seen, it's a combination of both, and that if we can only get one, then we'll still do that, because the Pursuma Nisa component that comes from the external, where it's at least meaningful externally. So then that much we're going to hold on to, but if it's a complete contradiction on every level, then maybe not. But if we can at least get the external symbolism, we'll do that. But ideally, a connection between the emotion and the external would be the best. And that's presumably its initial formulation. So perhaps this all goes back to that diuk in the Rambam. And again, it's a diuk that's pointed out very often because of its contrast with the Haggadah. So we can come back to that point, that the Haggadah has the language Chayev Adam Liros Es Atzmo, and the Rambam has the language Chayev Adam Laharos Es Atzmo. So are we talking about how you see yourself or how you display yourself to others? So the truth is, ideally, to go back to a favorite word, there would be a synergy between the two. And that is probably also the Iker Pursuma Nisa. Right? That the main way in which you publicize and make meaningful the Nes of Pesach is that you show you can put yourself back into that moment as absolutely as possible. So to the greater extent you can actually insert yourself into history, the more powerful the Pursuma Nisa is. So it's not simply a museum where you're trying to remind people of what happened a long time ago, but the fact that you are seeing yourself in that moment is itself the greatest realization of the goal. And they synergize each other, because the more you can display it externally, the more you hopefully can feel it internally, if there is that possibility. And the more you feel it internally, then the greater the impact of the display. And this perhaps could give us a path towards the whole Haseva concept. So just to quickly recap what we said today, so we noticed again a little more about that question of how integral it is to the mitzvah. With Dalet Kosos, it seems like it was two angles in the rush about whether it even considered adding on Kosos if you did it again. As far as matzah, we assume that it makes sense that the mitzvah cannot really be totally invalidated by the absence of Haseva. But we saw maybe it's not 100% the case. And we talked about if you really have to do Haseva again, do matzah again to do Haseva, why don't you just do it with Korech? And the notion that there is a stira between matzah derabanan, matzah deraisa, and mara derabanan. Here it would be derabanan. So we talked about maybe it's even more than derabanan, even in this case, and maybe it's at least a kiyum in HaTorah. We mentioned the comparison that was drawn between that and the statement of the Chassam Sofer about Halal and Chanukah and the celebration of Purim, that both of those fulfill a value in HaTorah even as they are clearly post-dating the Torah, and that maybe we have that aspect here as well. Prima Gadim, in fact, by the way, says that if somebody swears he's not going to do his Seva, which you can almost imagine somebody doing, it can get so frustrating. You can imagine somebody taking a shvuah, he's not going to do his Seva. So the Prima Gadim says that's considered to be a shvuah against the Torah, that it's somehow it's considered min haTorah enough that it would be a shvuah against the Torah to say you're not going to do that. It's a striking point. And then we consider Rav Zilberstein's situation about the Holocaust and about a lack of chayrus there, and where he brought in the question of the burglar who makes you eat matzah and the assumption that there's no haseba. How much is that comparable? And how much is that comparable to Talmud Eitzel Rabbo? Or should we say, no, Talmud Eitzel Rabbo, we would never say not to do that, because that is at least derech chayrus as far as that's concerned. That's an interesting technical question that's prompted by that. Maybe I'll mention privately mention tomorrow if you want to hear about it. It takes off in other directions. But that comparison itself was instructive. And then we got back into the Rav Yah and the question of why we still do this Bizman HaZef. It's not any more meaningful, and do you have to? And that was itself a whole range of opinions among the poskim. The Aruch HaShulchan taking the position that it's actually more of a Pursuma Nisa if it's something that doesn't fit our culture. In fact, it does make it into the Manushtana, which itself indicates that it has a role as far as that's concerned. But we also noted that that has to be a plan B kind of svara, because clearly at one point in history it did fit. So the fact that it doesn't fit now, maybe that enhances the persimmonista components. But initially, presumably, there is an integration between the message and this particular practice, and that maybe that's itself the ideal, that there's a persimmonista component, so we certainly will hold on to that, even if it doesn't necessarily fit. But the ideal of the persimmonista is that everything should synergize, and that the internal attitude should match with the external display, and that each should contribute to the other, and that's perhaps the actual persimmonista of Pesach night, to whatever extent we can put ourselves back in that moment, is the greater degree of fulfillment of what we're trying to accomplish. Okay, so with that, our agenda is the famous Ran tomorrow. We are definitely running back to him as long as that took. So you saw some sources about that today. Maybe tomorrow I'll give you a few more. I'll give you some of the Achronim to look at if you have a little bit more time. So you'll get a little bit of a sense of how he fits into the larger picture. And then we'll try to explore that a little bit, all the implications of what the Ran says. And then we'll see. It'll segue us into Dalet Kosos and related themes that come from that. So I wish you all a wonderful day. Should be only good things. Stay dry, stay safe, stay warm, stay healthy, and look forward to seeing you again in person tomorrow. Check in at Zoom at 9 o'clock if you're in person, and everything else should be good. Okay.